As I said before, my cousins, the daughters of Ed Borchers, my uncle, when they were at the Oklahoma Territory, remembered that the Daltons, one or two of them, of the brothers, had stayed at their home one night. But just what the significance of whether they were at that time bandits or not, I don't know. But they did stay at the home in the Oklahoma Territory. I think it'd be interesting to tell about the adventures of Father Murphy. Now, my father was elected mayor the first time to close up Decatur in relation to houses and saloons. Mm-hmm. It was a wide open town at that time. And Father Murphy, and for one, who was the head of the Catholic Church here, St. Patrick's Church, and other of the ministers of the Protestant faith, all supported my father for election as mayor to clean up Decatur. Now, Father Murphy ruled the parish with an iron hand. He was a very, very strong-minded and able priest, and very much beloved and liked by the people. Very good friends. My father and Father Murphy were very good friends. And one day, after my father had been able to run all the girls out of town and to close up all the saloons, Father Murphy came post haste into my father's office in the old courthouse. That is the third, number three courthouse in Decatur, the third one. And he said, Charles, something terrible's happened. Last night, two men came to the parish house and asked for the girls. He says, do you know where they are? They're just in that house just east of the church, St. Patrick's Church. I want it closed up right now. I'm not going to have anybody else coming knocking at the parish door, which is just west of the Catholic St. Patrick's Church. So my father, so there wouldn't be a tip-off of any way, he says, okay, come with me and we'll get my buggy and we'll go out there and I'll have the Black Mariah with the horses and police and we'll go and raid that place right now and close it up. So Father Murphy had his cassock on and he got in the buggy with my father and they began to go out to El Dorado Street and then east on El Dorado to raid the house. So they had, of course, the police with them in the Black Mariah. They got out there. Father Murphy was so incensed at the indignity of having a house next to the church that he was the first out of the buggy, and you might say he led the raid because he went up to the front porch and the door without knocking. He pulled up his cassock and kicked in the door. Now, my father always enjoyed that story because it was just typical of Father Murphy. He was very quick and able, and he made up his mind in an instant that he wasn't about to have this going on next to his church. And I can't say that I blame him. So they raided the place and closed it up. Around 1908 or 1909, when my father was mayor the first time, he had gone down to the old dam because the city was, for whatever reason, I don't know. Anyway, he was at the old dam, and they were some boys fishing there, and one boy fell in and was drowning. So that was before the road was there, just back in the woods. And so my father took his shoes off real quickly and dived in, took off his coat and shoes and dived in with the rest of his clothes on and rescued this boy and pulled him out on the bank. And it wasn't until after the boy was rescued that my father realized that he had jumped in with his solid gold watch that had to then be taken all cleaned and taken care of because of the getting all wet and in the water of the Sangamon River. But it wasn't but maybe 2-3 years ago, some man came to me and told me, reminded me of the fact that it was his grandfather that, when he was a boy, that my father had rescued. Uh-huh. About 1923, when my father was mayor the second time, the Ku Klux Klan held a big meeting where the Mound Hill is, the north part of Decatur. There were some 10,000 Klansmen and their families came in from all over, as far as Indiana. A very, very big meeting. And they had come to my father to ask permission to a parade. So they were going to march what is now North Main Street or North Water Street into Decatur and circle and then go back to their encampment at the mound to north of town. My father told them it'd be okay to parade, but they could wear their sheets, but they could not wear anything over their heads. Their heads had to be bare, and their faces had to be able to be seen. So they agreed that they would do this. So when the time came from the parade, the Klansmen lined up, and I suspect it's quite a long line, because even with children and their wives, 10,000, a lot of people. They all obviously didn't march. But the Grand Dragon, whoever the title he had led the parade, was in front. Now there's an old schoolhouse to the north. It's near, close to where the tracks are, and not too far from where the Traver Supply Company is today. And right in the middle of the road, which was not, of course, paved at that time, just a country road, was a huge poplar tree, later cut down after a big fight in the community about cutting down that poplar tree. It was a very popular tree. It was a very popular tree because it was during the summer, it was a nice place to rest for the horses and wagons of farmers coming into Decatur for a breather. Anyway, it's near the edge of town, so my father went out with some of the police to meet and check the incoming parade of the Klansmen. Well, they came up to where my father and the police were standing, and they all had their hoods on. My father stopped them, and the Grand Dragon stopped the parade. And my father said, "Now you understand that our agreement was you were not to wear your hoods." The Grand Dragon said, "We are going to wear our hoods on this parade." And my father said, "No, you are not." The Grand Dragon looked up and down the line. He said, "How are you going to stop us?" Upon which my father reached into his belt and pulled out a revolver and stuck it against the stomach of the Grand Dragon and said, "This will stop you." I says, "I want you to know that you can certainly overpower us, but you are the first to undergo. And if you think that I'm going to be afraid to pull the trigger, you better not take the chance, because I am not afraid to pull the trigger." Upon which the Grand Dragon had them all take off their hoods, and they prayed through Decatur without their hoods. During the time that my Aunt Leona was teaching school in Macon County, she would drive home, like most of the girls did, her sisters, to their home around Ray's Bridge, and where our cattle farm was. We raised cattle up there. Well, one weekend, she got home a little early, and she discovered that her parents, my grandparents, had driven into Decatur for supplies. She was there by herself. Well, she heard a noise, and she went out to the well that was there, and she saw that a young pig had fallen somehow, fell in the well. How that happened, I don't know, but the pig was down there. So she climbed down in the well to try to get the pig. She found she couldn't get out. She held the pig and herself, but she was thoroughly wet, and it was cold down that water and cold in the well. And then she would yell. Finally, she heard someone driving on the road, and she yelled and attracted attention. It was, I don't know who the name was, but the name
someone was passing
somebody
by.
Passing. And so they came and looked into the well to be surprised to find that there, my aunt, as a young woman, was down in the well holding up a pig. Well, after a good deal of looking around for a rope and helping, they finally dragged the pig. Aunt Leona wouldn't let loose of the pig. They finally got the pig and Aunt Leona up out of the well, upon which then she came down with a very good case of pneumonia from being down in that well. And as I recollect, they said that there was one telephone line to a doctor in Cerro Gordo, and the telephone was 3 miles away. When she came down with pneumonia, they had to drive 3 miles to the telephone to call the doctor in Cerro Gordo to find out what to tell him about it and ask what to do. And so by means of the telephone, he gave the necessary instructions of the preliminary care of Aunt Leona down with the pneumonia as a result of saving the pig. My uncle Will Bowman, that is the only brother of my mother, was interested in raising cattle. And so my grandfather, we raised cattle on the farm. It was a cattle farm. They would sell cattle in Chicago, whatever, wherever. And so they wanted to buy some cattle in St. Louis that was coming in from off the plains. So my grandfather gave some thousands of dollars to his son, my uncle Will Bowman, to go down to St. Louis and buy cattle to ship back on the railroad, the Wabash, to be put out on the land for fattening. Well, he went to St. Louis and he attended the auction down there or the stockyards or wherever he bought them. And he bought, he spent all the money buying the cattle. And then he saw to it that made arrangements for the cattle to come back on cattle cars to Decatur from St. Louis. He paid for the money, paid the money, it's all gone. Mm-hmm. But being a young man, I suspect from what I understand that he wanted to show what a big shot he was, so he decided to come back, not with the cattle, like he should have, but on a pasture train, which he did. When he got back to Decatur, he waited to meet the cattle. But when the cattle came in, he immediately discovered that the cattle was sent, that they brought him from St. Louis was not the cattle that he had bought.
And not so good, actually.
They were
sure.
Not so good, correct. And there was quite a little loss as a result of him deciding to come on the pasture train and not right along with the freight train carried with the cattle cars. When the Lincolns first moved to, came to Macon County, they came because John Hanks, their cousin, lived near the Boiling Springs area. Now at that time there was no road west of Decatur, north of the Sangamon. The road went south of the Sangamon towards Springfield. Now there were no bridges at that time, so there was a ford across the Sangamon River. Now that ford is still existent. I doubt if very many people know about it, but the ford, there are still some of the stones, cut stones, by that ford, and that ford lies between the present State Route 48 bridge, southwest of Decatur, and the Northwestern Railroad Bridge. That's where the ford was that the Lincolns always used to go to their home south of Decatur on the north side of the Sangamon. Mm-hmm. So they had to cross that ford to carry the road south of, go along the road south of the Sangamon River in the direction of Mount Auburn, which was the old post road, past the Warnick Tavern, which they call the Halfway House, and Then thereabouts, shortly, a short distance west of the Warnick Halfway Tavern, they would turn back north and cross by another ford, the Sangamon River, to their home on the north bank of the Sangamon River. That'd be south where Harristown is today. Now along that Mount Auburn Road, that was an old trace, very old road. During the days before the railroads, and the first railroad came here, if I remember right, about 1851 or 52, the Wabash. That road was the one followed by countless streams of people moving west by their Conestoga wagons. And they went through Springfield and on to the west towards St. Joseph, Missouri, which was a jumping off place for the crossing of the plains to the west and to California. I suspect if the dead could arise out of their graves, there'd be scores and scores of unknown graves of the dead all the way from Decatur, and of course the east and west of Decatur, to Springfield and on west, because they had to bury the dead right along the way. In 1828, my cousin Floyd Austin's great-great-grandfather went to Vandalia along with John Ward and a fellow by the name of Smith, first name I don't remember. The purpose of this trip was to go to the legislature in Vandalia, our first capital, to get permission to form a new county, which of course became Macon County. The reasons they did this was at that time we were part of Shelby County, and Shelbyville was the seat of this area. But the distance was so great because of the terrible roads. They were just during the winter and the spring and the fall, and the time of rain, they were practically impassable. And these people felt that it was necessary for the development of what became Decatur and Macon County to form this new county and a new county seat, which of course is Decatur, that we would be able to develop much faster and better to have our own county and our own county seat than Shelbyville. So the legislature did give permission to do this, and we did detach the land that became Macon County and part of what is now Piatt County and part of DeWitt County into the new county of Macon. Now, Macon County was named after Nathaniel Macon, one of the signers of the Declaration of Independence. And of course, Decatur was named after Stephen Decatur, who was a commodore during the War of 1812 and also led the attack on the Barbary pirates in Tripoli. Now the Austin family is now extinct in Macon County. The original Austins on the male side is extinct now, except for this cousin of mine, Floyd Austin. And Floyd and his wife, Leona Jostis Austin, are now retired in Florida and have been for many years. They originally farmed in Pleasant View Township in south of Decatur. And Floyd Austin, as a young man, as a boy, lived on the farm southwest of Decatur, where the Lincoln, and on this farm, his original farm, was where the original Lincoln cabin had been erected by the Lincoln family in 1830. And he knew exactly, of course, and pointed out to some people lately, where the stone was that I have mentioned before in the story of the original Lincoln cabin. It's now on the land owned by Gary Johnson. My thesis for my bachelor's degree at the University of Illinois was the pre-white history of Macon County and this area. I went back into the records, as I have already mentioned, clear to Quebec and the records of the French. Now, part of my study in relation to this was to locate any village sites or camping sites of the Indians along the Sangamon, Stevens Creek, and Big Creek, and Friends Creek. I went up and down the banks everywhere on these creeks and the river. I had never found any village site in Macon County. However, there are countless camping sites. It's very easy to locate camping sites. The Indians generally, well, of course, they had to drink, so it's always along a creek or where there's some waterway, enough water. And we had quite a few camping places along Friends Creek, Big Creek, and Stevens Creek. Now, it's easy to locate a camping ground by walking over a plowed field near these creeks or a river. All you have to do is, after the field is plowed, and the rains have come, is look for chips. You see, for every arrowhead, for every spear point, for every knife, there would be maybe 300-400 chips. Mm-hmm. And all of these chips are conchoidal in shape, mm-hmm. bigger, mm-hmm. smaller, mm-hmm. or bigger in size. But just by walking along the ground in a plowed field after rain, you could immediately discover these chips mm-hmm. if there was a camping place. Mm-hmm. It was nearly always on a slope to the south, so the water would run off and the ground would dry the faster in the heat of the sun. So we have many of these camping places in Macon County. Now, not only archaic, but woodland Indians, and of course, towards the end, before the whites came. Now, the people that are last known to have lived in Macon County by a historical record were the Kickapoo. And they had, I'm sure, camping places, the same camping places on top of camping places for maybe 10,000 years after the retreat of the last glacier. I went into the ROTC, that's a Reserve Officers Training Corps at the University of Illinois. And in 1931, when I graduated, I also was given my commission as a second lieutenant of cavalry. From then on, during the training periods, I attended the various training places like Fort Sheridan, Camp Custer, the fort down there at St. Louis, I forget the name of the moment.
Fort Leonard Wood.
No. That's in Missouri. Mm-hmm. That's infantry. Mm-hmm. But then also Camp Perry, Ohio, where I shot on the national rifle team at the national matches and received quite a few medals in relation to shooting. Not only the Springfield rifle, but the small, the Colt automatic, 45 Colt automatic. Became an instructor of small arms from the Army of the United States with a certificate as instructor. And when World War II began to approach in 1941, I was ordered as a reserve officer, and by that time I received a captain's commission. To report to Fort Knox in February 1941. And from there, I became one of the first officers to command a company of trainees who were designated for the newly being formed Armored Force. Under General Jack W. Hurd, the commanding general of the AFRTC, that's an Armored Force Replacement Training Center. From there, during the period of Fort Knox, I was sent on special missions by the order of General Jack Hurd. I don't know what I carried, they were in pouches, but I was flown numbers of times to Gander towards Iceland, where I met a British officer who picked up the packet that I was carrying mm-hmm. to Gander, and then I'd fly back to Fort Knox. I think it probably had to do with formation of armor mm-hmm. because it was an armored force training center. Mm-hmm. I also was sent to Guantanamo with similar packets to our base there in 1941, mm-hmm. in the summer of 1941, and the fall of 1941. So, of course, we crossed it to Gander. We stopped at Newfoundland, and then went on across the ocean to Gander. Mm-hmm. Now, from there, I was assigned to, for a time being, well, I was assigned to G2. That was to partially intelligence of the army, and I ended up in France under General George Patton. Now, Patton was a cavalry officer, and I was. I'm just on a saluting basis with him. All he would say was, Captain Borchers or Borchers, do this mm-hmm. or do that. But we were both cavalry. He was a general of cavalry, or general, but really of the armor, because he had become armor, like mm-hmm. all cavalry had become mm-hmm. armor. Now, when I landed in France, the Third Army was had just been formed. That was in August of 1944. Yes, it's around the 1st of August, 2nd of August, 3rd of August of 1944. And we became operational. I was assigned to the 80th Infantry Division as a G2, a member of G2. Now, the during the first week of August, there was a move. It was the 5th Corps of the 3rd Army. Now, the 5th Corps consisted of the 2nd French Armored Division. They called it the Division Blonde, as I recollect, and the 80th Infantry Division. Well, we were in the process of breaking through the German lines, and there was a reestablishment of areas of attack, and it necessitated, the normal general army foul-up, that three divisions, the 80th Infantry Division, the 2nd French Armored Division, and another division, I don't remember what division, the 26th possibly, or the 28th possibly, of another corps, had to pass through the same area simultaneously to take up their new attack positions. Now, there was an absolutely incredible foul-up of traffic. After all, just a train of a division could maybe be 15 miles long. Mm-hmm. And here we have three trains, three armored divisions, all trying to go through the same network at the same time, and it was just a mess. Now, the 2nd French, the 80th Infantry and the 2nd French Armored Division were in the process of colliding with each other in the rear mm-hmm. areas to take up their new battle positions. Mm-hmm. Now, I speak French. And there was a very big mess up. Oh, Lord, what was the name of that town? It was, see if I can remember it. Oh, no, my. I can't remember the place at the moment. The name of it, it may come to me later on. But it was in that area that we were having various columns trying to get through. Nobody wanted to give way. Well, by VOCG, I was ordered. I was asked if anybody could speak French, and I said I do.
Excuse me, what is VOCG?
Oh, the Verbal Order Commanding General.
Oh.
I was asked if I could, if anybody could speak French. I said I do. He said, "Go with that French column." Now there was only, you see, a column of an armored division is just not one column; it's many columns. And this particular column I was assigned to was under the command of a French Colonel D. Colonel D, as I recollect. Anyway, I was to go with that column until the time came that I could be released. And I didn't know how long. I thought it might be a day or so, but it ended up I was with him, the 2nd French Armored Division, for 10 days. And I went as far as the 2nd French Armored Division to Rambouillet, which is about 14 miles south of Paris, where we had an assembly area to attack and liberate Paris. Now the French, the Eisenhower, Patton was of course in the really command of the 2nd French Armored Division because it was under it was in the 3rd Army. Now the 2nd French Armored Division was commanded by General Leclerc of the French Army. He was quite a general, a very fine general. And the 2nd, but the French wanted to have the French liberate Paris. So on August the 23rd, we were assembled at Rambouillet to attack Paris on the 24th. And that evening, the order came that all Americans, there weren't very many of us there, but the few Americans who were not to go into Paris with the attack of the 2nd French Armored Division to liberate Paris. So unfortunately, I missed the liberation of Paris, which was quite a ball from what I heard from my friends afterwards. You see, most of the fighting was done in the environs of Paris, in the outskirts, but the underground, the Force Francaise Interieure, the FFE, had practically liberated all of Paris except some German troops in the Bois de Boulogne, and some of the Hotel de Ville, and a few other hotels on the Seine River. I don't remember the names of those hotels. Perhaps they had George Sank still in possession of the Germans. I don't know. But the resistance in Paris had already really liberated Paris, and the 2nd French Armored went into the actual city.
Well, was the French interior or the underground?
No, that's what I'm talking about. The Force Francaise Interieure
is the underground.
The FFE,
right.
Yes, the underground. So I went into Paris, but not with them. I went in, and I went to Versailles, I went to Versailles. And that was on the 24th. The attack on Paris was made in two points. Colonel D and Colonel Billotte, as I recollect. And Colonel D went in at the Porte d'Orléans and Billotte the Porte de Versailles. Well, since I had to return to my division on the 24th, I went, Versailles had already been liberated, that branch, that point of the French 2nd Armored Division. And I into Versailles shortly after the taking of Versailles. Well, the French guards that were there, not soldiers, but the regular guards, the police that guarded the chateau, were there, and I ordered them to bring me a stepladder, a rather tall stepladder, and I took from the Petit Salon 2 droplets from the great chandeliers that hung in the Hall of Mirrors, and then on either side of the Hall of Mirrors is the, on either end is a little salon that they call the Petit Salon. And if you look up at the chandelier right there, that very bottom droplet on that chandelier, the bottom droplet on that chandelier are the two crystals from the Petit Salon under which the Emperor Napoleon has walked and Josephine, and then later on his wife, the daughter of the Queen of or Empress of Austria-Hungary, the Habsburgs, and the after the war of the Franco-Prussian War, the German Empire was formed, and the German Emperor was crowned German Emperor, and all of the Marshals of France, and all these events. So right in this room are two crystals from the great chandeliers of the palace, or the chateau or palace of Versailles, built by Louis the 14th, King of France. After I had a Jeep and a driver, and after I had collected as souvenirs these two crystals from the chandeliers, I had to hunt down the and report into the 80th Infantry Division, which I did, and I was then assigned to the reconnaissance of the 80th Infantry Division, but simultaneously I was still working for G2, 3rd Army. And I was with the 80th Infantry Division recon for September, around the 1st of September to around the middle of November, when I was then assigned to the I and E section of the forward echelon of 3rd Army the 80th Infantry Division headquarters, but I was still reporting to G2 of 3rd Army. Of course, during the time of the recon, we were the actual points. The fact is that every other day or so, for those 2 months approximately, 2 months and a half, I was the actual point of the advance of the 3rd Army in my area of the 80th Infantry Division. We were advancing through, the Fort Lehay, Fort A, Lehay, Dillard, of course we crossed the Moselle River, we attacked across the Moselle River at Dillard, Pont-a-Mousson. I was wounded had a slight wound, artillery wound near Pont-a-Mousson. From a German counterattack on the morning of, I think it was September the 12th. They opened up with artillery, and that was followed closely by German infantry, and they retook the village of St. Genevieve, where I was, and or near where I was. I was in a little forest, a little small patch of timber, a couple hundred yards away from St. Genevieve, St. Genois, and the Germans took it. I could hear them taking the village, and the artillery is still falling on our patch of timber. And then it led up, and the recon outfit took off, leaving me there, and I had to get away by getting on a half track with some artillery reservers of the 313th Field Artillery. And as we came down the hill from the forest to cross the Bailey Bridge at Dillard, a German tank started to fire at us, and machine guns were flying all around us, but never hit any of the vehicle or hit any of us. I thought I was going to be bounced off of that half track because we were going about 300 miles an hour, or so it seemed, out across country. And I hope that's not taken seriously.
Were you injured?
I was wounded by artillery fire that morning. In my legs.
But you didn't get help?
No, well, that's impossible. That's when I got on the. That's when I got on the half track, and took off with the artillery observers to get back across the Bailey Bridge at Dillard across the Moselle. Mm-hmm. The reason I was left behind by the recon was that I had gone forward to check out a machine gun position we had at the far eastern edge of the patch of timber that they had already cleared out. Now, what had happened was that this German counterattack, there was a little the St. Genevieve, there was a little road from St. Genevieve to run to Bizemont. And another German tank had come down the road from Genevieve in the direction of Bizemont, and they had seen the vehicles of the recon in the timber. So they had opened up on the timber with the German tanks, Tiger tanks. Well, when they opened up on the timber, whole trees were just going flying through the air, and the branches and everything, and all hell was breaking loose, and all our people got into some German foxholes that were scattered throughout that timber. And they just happened that the 702nd Anti-Tank Battalion was in a little patch of timber to the south, or to one side anyway. I think it was to the south, as I recollect. And they heard the noise. It was very foggy that morning, very, very foggy. The artillery fire started at 4 o'clock in the morning and continued to 6 o'clock when the counterattack came in. Well, the 702nd Anti-Tank Battalion recognized the sound of the German guns, just like you fire a gun right now, I recognize the sound, German or American, small arms or whatever. And they moved their vehicles forward a little bit through the fog, and they saw this German tank firing into the timber where the recon was being pinned down. Now, the very first shot of that tank hit the Jeep that I had my clothes and my blankets and my bedding roll in. The first shot knocked it to pieces. That second shot hit one of our trucks that had the loot in. Now, when I mean loot, I suppose I better explain that. You see, we had captured a German truck quite a time before, and in that, any one of the patrols of the recon that went out, they run into some goodies, like maybe Alpine silver cheese or German sausage or confiture, the jelly or whatever that's good of a German mess, anything good to eat. We would, that patrol that captured it would send it back to this truck. Now, Patton given orders that all German vehicles have to be turned into the motor pool, so we kept this truck hid away from the Third Army and the division headquarters. We needed it for our loot, our food and drink, and the cognac and rum and wine and so on. We were well equipped. Well, we had captured some of the best Swiss cheese from a German mess sometime before. And that was in this particular truck. And the second shot hit that truck, and all our loot was destroyed on that second shot. All the things that we had been collecting for a couple of weeks. It was a sad, sad day. So we had to conceal that truck by keeping it forward. Obviously, if it was in behind there, somebody was likely to see that truck and the commander of the truck and say that's got to go to a motor pool of the Third Army or Corps. Maybe at that time we were in the 12th Corps, the Corps motor pool. That's why we kept that truck so far forward, and that's why it got knocked off. Well, anyway, that taught us a lesson, I suppose. But anyway, to continue about the 702nd Anti-Tank Battalion. The anti-tank gun that went forward in the fog saw the German tank. There was a German officer or tank commander in the turret of the German tank. But the Germans didn't see the anti-tank gun of the 702nd Battalion. So they took good aim at the tank, and their first shot hit the turret of the German tank with a German officer or German tank commander in the turret. And the last they saw of him, he had a Smitzer in his hand, and he was peppering our woods with his Smitzer. The last they saw of him was the turret. He and the turret of the tank disappeared in one with that first shot into the timber. And of course, that knocked out the tank, and that ended that. And that's when the recon, when the fire left up. That's when the recon loaded into their vehicles that were left and took off. We didn't lose a man. We were very, very fortunate because there was quite a bit of heavy firing there. they took off and left me up there at the point where the machine gun, I thought the machine gun position had been, but had left. Well, I went back. There was a cow path that I had been laying in during this artillery bombardment for 2 hours, and I went back and laid down because I could hear the fighting coming in my direction. It was a small arms fire, and I thought I better keep down till I knew what was going on. Well, some distance through the fog, I could see some figures running down the path, the cow path, in my direction, and I couldn't tell whether they were American or German because of the fog. And I laid and watched them with my rifle and watched them running towards me. Well, the problem was solved instantly because all of a sudden a German machine gun opened up on this column. So I knew they were Americans. Mm-hmm. I saw our column of maybe 5, 6, 8 men. I saw them falling into the path. Mm-hmm. And it just happened as I was laying there, my eyes went to the sound of this machine gun, that was being fired, German machine gun. It was one of these little machine guns that has a very quickly removable barrel. And it's one man or two man, two man really to operate, one man can operate it. And my eyes went right to where the sound was, because I could see the flashing of the machine gun, of the firing. And right there above that, the stock of the machine gun, I could see the round helmet, just like a perfect bull's eye on a regular Army practice range, rifle range. Mm-hmm. And my gun was pointing exactly at his head. I didn't know he was there. It was pointed right at him. So I just squeezed the trigger, and the firing instantly stopped, and he fell over the gun. Well, about 2 days later, after that village had been retaken twice or three times, it had been lost and retaken, lost and retaken, lost and retaken, and there had been quite a little fight up there at St. Genevieve, I went back, and there was this... Two days later, when I returned to that area, I drove by with my Jeep, and I saw this German soldier still laying over the machine gun. And so I stepped out of the Jeep and picked up his helmet, which had rolled off his head and was laying by his head, and looked at it, and I saw that it had my bullet hole through his helmet. And so I threw the helmet into the Jeep, put it in a box and sent it home, and it's right now in this house, upstairs with the other war souvenirs. During the period, my division was one of the 5 iron divisions so designated by General Patton, and of course we were in action about 260 days. I was, of course, in action during this period of time every day as a recon or an I&E man throughout this fighting. And I was generally, I was always at the front. I don't believe in some 240-250 days I was ever outside of German rifle range, let alone artillery. I suspect that I can't remember of a time that I wasn't shelled at least once a day till maybe half a dozen times a day. It was a normal procedure when you're at the front. But there's so many things happened, just like I've recounted. Every day was a day like that, with these different adventures. Many of these things stick in my mind, and the stories involved stick in my mind. And I could tell, but I think it'd be too difficult to tell them all in relation to the history of Decatur. After all, I was just one of many soldiers who was in the Army from Decatur, and they had, many of them had similar experiences. For example, one man from Decatur did receive the Congressional Honor. I'm sorry that I don't remember his name, but I don't. We had one Congressional Medal of Honor winner in Decatur. But the best the highest medal I received was the Croix de Guerre with Palm, That's the French Medal, equivalent to the Congressional Medal of Honor, but of course from France. I think I'll tell about the time bombs at St. Avold as another period of time. You see, we had crossed the Sale River under intense bombardment, and the river was in flood. It was a very difficult thing to do, but we did it. The Third Army did it. I could have read at 6 o'clock in the morning, without any daylight as yet. This attack started on the morning of November the 8th, and I could have read a letter by the light of the artillery fire. Mm-hmm. It was our fire going on the Germans. Mm-hmm. So it wasn't anything we had to do to protect ourselves. We could walk around pretty safely because of the intensity of our fire, so we could cross, make it a self-crossing over the Sale River near Nomeny. Well, we crossed the river and went to Nomeny. We headed in the direction of Saarbrücken. And on the way, and in the way, was the French town of St. Avold. It was the headquarters of the German general staff in the defense of the Western Front at that time, or shortly before that time, till we drove them out. But we went in around December the 2nd or 3rd or 4th of December 1944, and we had captured a prisoner, German prisoner, who had told us that 32 time bombs had been left in the town in different buildings that he didn't know who or where they were, which buildings, but the time bombs had been left there by the retreating German army placed by their engineers. So we pulled into kind of bad weather, and we were making the habit of staying in undercover whenever we could instead of in the field. So we picked out a big building. It had been a barracks. And one of the first things we did that evening was to everyone, officers and men, we all very carefully checked that building to be certain that there was no time bombs there. I remember that in the basement there was quite a pile of coal and these little round briquettes that they have overseas. And after we had checked the building and moved this pile of coal to make certain no time bombs were buried in it, that someone that had helped shovel and move the coal said, "My God," he said, "we forgot to check the floor where the coal was, where we moved the coal to."
And had you moved it back?
No. So we all got together, and nobody said a word. We all moved that coal back to its original spot because we wanted to be darn sure nothing was buried where we had just put the coal. But we found no time bombs. However, the engineers of our division had moved into another building, and that building did have a time bomb, and to our surprise, and I suspect theirs, it did. They did not find the time bomb, mm-hmm. and it did blow up. Mm-hmm. And as I remember, some 150 of our men were buried in the ruins of that building.
And they were engineers,
yes, and were killed. It was a very bad time, and there was a lot of work to be done to dig them out of the ruins of the building. I might say that I was in the Gestapo headquarters in St. Avold, looking over it, and there was a very beautiful little paperweight with a dove in the paper. It's sitting right over there, and I'll show it to you.
Okay.
And I picked it up. It's off the chief Gauleiter's desk. And I picked it up and stuck it in my pocket and brought it home. It was such a nice little souvenir, so easy to carry. Mm-hmm. And that building, about 2 days later, blew up also. They had set the time bombs from anywhere from 1 to 30 days.
Oh.
And it blew up, but it's a good... So the only thing that I know of that came out of there intact was this little paperweight.
Mm-hmm.
I'll show it to you shortly. But that you might say, is the story of the time bombs. That was something we had to watch all the time, was booby traps, mm-hmm. Whether it be time bombs or bouncing Bettys
what was it,
a bouncing Betty is buried in the ground, has three little prongs, Just sticks up the ground just a short distance, maybe a couple of inches. And if they're covered by leaves, you can't see them. And if your foot strikes any of those prongs, it discharges a cartridge in the ground underneath the bomb, which is thrown up about 6-8 feet into the air. And it goes like this. That's the cartridge exploding about a second or two, about 3 seconds later, is a real explosion. Mm-hmm. It's an exploding bomb, and it's a fragmentation bomb, and it throws a fragmentation all around. Mm-hmm. And of course, if you hear that first little explosion, you have to fall to the ground instantly. And even then, well, you'll probably be struck in the back by the fragments coming from the bomb that's thrown into the air to explode a couple of seconds, 2-3 seconds later, and scatters the fragmentation around an area. I don't know the area, but you never can get too far away from something like that. Another thing is I'd never move any German equipment without tying a fishing line to it or something and pulling it at a distance, because even pencils would be booby trapped that would blow your hand off or blow out your eyes. Mm-hmm. So you had to be very, very cautious no matter what you did, because of the booby traps that were left behind by the German troops. But going on, let's see, it was December the 16th, as I recollect, we received a patent, received notice that to attend a meeting in, may have been Luxembourg, I don't know, probably Luxembourg, but that's when the German army made the great attack through the Ardennes to try to drive a wedge between our armies and make a this wedge would have divided the first and then a few days later the third army. You see, we were a very highly trained army. Patton was an incredibly great general, one of the greatest generals our country ever had. And when he attended the meeting in Luxembourg, the situation didn't look too good. The Germans were headed at that time already well into Luxembourg. So Patton told Eisenhower and Bradley and other generals that we would be able to move in immediately. Well, that was true. Now, our division, our army, of course, was in an attack position, and we're attacking our own artillery, that's the 80th Infantry. We're actually firing with our artillery on Saarbrücken, and our forward elements of infantry were actually engaged with the enemy defending Saarbrücken. What happened was, that was about December the 18th or 19th, I kind of forget which, but right around in there. And that night, they pulled in a green division, just from the States, I don't know what, even the number of it. And their artillery was placed along our artillery batteries that were firing, and our infantry and their infantry were together. And the following morning, either the 18th or 19th, we pulled out, and as far as the artillery was concerned, the artillery took, this new division, took up the firing patterns, possibly TOT or whatever, and so the Germans didn't realize that our division was pulling out. Now, there were three divisions were pulled out by Patton to make the first initial movement towards the city of Luxembourg. Now, this was important because the great radio station, one of the biggest in Europe, was in Luxembourg, and we had to seize it before the German prong that was approaching Luxembourg City would reach it. So those three divisions were my own division, the 80th Infantry, the 4th Armored Division, and I believe it was the 26th Division was the 3rd Division, and we pulled out. Some pulled out while it was still dark. And for the first time, lights were turned on. It was snowing. Lights were turned on of the trucks and vehicles and tanks. And we went across roads. The whole three divisions were en route. Every road was jammed with men and armor all heading towards the Metz. And we passed through Metz. It was an incredible sight. All this armament going towards Luxembourg to the north, And we passed through Metz, and then we headed towards Luxembourg. And as far as I know, as far as the 80th Infantry Division was concerned, I was in the very, with my driver, I was in the very first Jeep of my division that entered the city of Luxembourg. Now, all the people, I won't say all the people, but thousands of people were expecting the Germans to be back in there. The of course, the Germans were already on their radio or saying that they were coming and so on and so on. And so when we went into Luxembourg, city, we saw hundreds and hundreds of thousands of people fleeing, carts and vehicles.
They thought you were Germans.
They never thought we were Germans. They knew we were Americans. They thought that we were not going to be able to stop them. They didn't know the Third Army was moving. And when we saw them, we all heard later that some hundreds of people committed suicide in Luxembourg. But as we went in, we shouted to them, "Go home, clear the streets, Patton's coming, Patton's coming, the Third Army's coming." Well, by this time in Europe, we were a very famous army. Mm-hmm. Patton was a famous general. And when the people heard that we were the beginning of the Third Army, they outposted the first men of the Third Army, and the whole army was behind us coming. Mm-hmm. Why, they began to clear the streets, mm-hmm. and their fear left them. And they went home, because if they hadn't, we'd just have to, anything in the way, our tanks would just have to shove them out of the way, because there's no time to stop. Well, we passed on to my own outfit. We passed on through Luxembourg City, and we took them up about 14 miles outside of Luxembourg towards the German advance. We took up a defensive position in a little town called Reckens-les-Mers. I'll never forget it. And there was a hillside on the side, outside of the other side of the Reckens-les-Mers. It had a lot of trees on it. The thing that struck us when we went to Reckens-les-Mers was that there was nobody in the on the streets. The civilians had disappeared, no soldiers, nothing in sight, nobody in sight. Whenever you go towards a village that no one's in sight, the thing to do is be careful. So we passed on, we found that there was no enemy occupation in Reckens-les-Mers. And we passed on through there, and so we took up a defensive position on this side of this hill. The ridge of this hill just covers just like Christmas trees. And as we lay there waiting, at about 9, 10 o'clock in the morning, we saw the German advance guard coming. It was just a group of infantrymen. And behind them, maybe 500-600 yards, half a mile or more, was a support of the point, their point. And behind them, of course, was a larger group, which would be in front of their main body. Well, their support had a couple of tanks, and the support of the advance guard had a few guns and so on, part of them horse-drawn.
Mm-hmm.
And we had one artillery observer, I suppose it's either 313th or 314th Field Artillery. They were the artillery regiments of our division. And we knew that all the division was behind us to the other side of Reckens-les-Mers, because we knew we were on the move. We knew this, and we knew by this time that the artillery probably hadn't been, our artillery had not been probably dug in, but they were partially dug in, and they were ready to go into battle, whether they were dug in or not. So the artillery observer with us gave the range to radio to his own artillery unit. And we all were laying there watching, and the first shells came in a little bit on the wrong side to the away from us on the column, advancing column. We had let the point of German infantry go through, because after all they were running into some of the best of the best fighting soldiers of the Third Army, and it was their tough luck to run into our infantry who were expecting them. And not ours, so we let them go. We went, let them go on through. And when the artillery observer told us that he had given the coordinates, and they said, "Here she comes," well, we all went down because we weren't sure what the first ranging shells would be. But the first shells were away from us on the other side of the German column. Very quickly, he corrected the range, and the second salvo just came short on the other side, and then he corrected again, mm-hmm. That landed right on the road. And the thing with the German soldiers, of course, infantry and men, heard it and knew what to do. They jumped off their vehicles and took cover in the ditches and one thing and another. But the horses didn't know how to do that. And my goodness, those shells, that third salvo, landing amongst the horses, tore great holes in their bodies and
terrible.
Blew off their legs and some of the chunks out of their necks and so on. And they were screaming, as horses scream terribly when they're wounded. And they were screaming, and we all, most of us were ex-cavalrymen. We hated to see this. So when the shelling ceased and the fire lifted onto the advance guard, the main advance guard of the German advance force, well, we went down, took the prisoners and shot the horses because we couldn't stand to see them in that condition. But that stopped the German advance to Luxembourg in that sector, that area, our division area. Now, we were advancing, our infantry, we were advancing in the direction of Ettelbruck, and on just there's the Saar River runs through Ettelbruck, and just on the other side is Diekirch, another Luxembourg city. Well, we didn't cross the Saar, the Germans were still in Diekirch, but we took Ettelbruck. In fact, as I went up there, I wanted to, I had to find out how things were going to begin with as a member of G2. I had to find out what there was going. And also, I wanted to pick up for my friends a few bottles of wine out of which we did. It's the first bottle of Malaga wine that I had ever run into in France was in that town of Luxembourg. It came out of a doctor's basement. Of course, everybody was gone. And all the wine was there, and it was delicious wine. So I took that wine on back to the to my friends in I&E section. But just before the city of Ettelbruck, I personally took a little village of all by myself. No, its name was Unterfühlen, as I recollect. Anyway, later on after the war, I went back to see some of my friends, and I run into the two old ladies at who acted as a host and whose house I stayed in that night with some of my friends. Well, just before I went into Unterfühlen, I had a little crossroads. There was something I had never seen. That was a dead horse attached to some sort of a wagon, two-wheel wagon. And this horse had been struck by the tongue of another wagon or a piece of timber that was all through its body lengthwise by the force of the explosion. Now, as I say, some years later, I went back and took my grandson. I took my wife there on one of my visits back to visit some of my friends, and these old ladies were still alive, and they greeted me like a long-lost brother, and they called me the liberator of their town or village, and they got together the people of the church and the priest there, and insisted that my wife and I stay, which we did, and they had mass and a big dinner for us that night. So it's quite an interesting remembrance. Well, after the taking of Ettelbruck, by the way, I think the 4th Armored Division took Ettelbruck, and then followed up very closely by our own infantry of the 80th Infantry. In fact, as they may have ridden the tanks into the town, since I wasn't in at the taking of Ettelbruck, I can't say about that. Well, the German advance was continuing. Towards Liege and Antwerpen, and of course we were watching our situation maps all the time, and after I got home, I found out there was a lot of worry from the people here that that the Germans were going to maybe make it, and were worried about what was happening. But I can tell you, we were never worried. All we had to do is look at the maps to see that actually the German line was like a drive was like a big fist heading toward Liege, But we were to the south mm-hmm. of the, let's see, to the south. Up. No, we were, yeah, we were to the south and heading north. We could easily see that we were like a great fish getting ready to go forward and smash right through them and cut them mm-hmm. all off. Mm-hmm. So we weren't particularly alarmed about it. Now, we knew that that the more Germans went into the pocket that was forming in their advance towards the Bastogne, and they did surround Bastogne, mm-hmm. we knew that we'd have more prisoners mm-hmm. and more dead Germans. So we were not really alarmed about the thing at all. Well, as we were there in Etelbrook and around Dunkirk and Wilts, well, in the direction of Wilts, we weren't in Wilts yet, but towards Wilts and Heiderscheidergrund, I'll never forget that name. The defense of Bastogne was developing. The 101st Airborne was surrounded there, along with elements of the 10th Armored Division and other odd lots of troops were surrounding Bastogne. We were only about 20 miles away, and we could see every night in the snow the firing of the German guns and our own guns in defense, just lighting up the snow and the sky in every direction. We also heard German V-2 rockets being fired over us in the direction of Liege. We could hear them. They had a very peculiar high whine that we recognized. What they did in Liege, I don't know, as I wasn't there, but I know they were the V-2 rockets mm-hmm. being fired in that direction. Well, the snow and the weather was terrible. And on December 26th, the day after, well, the night before, for Christmas Eve, quite a few of us got together in a Catholic church with the roof off, and we sang Christmas hymns and Christmas songs. And on the 25th, we had a Christmas dinner, turkey. Though I might mention this time that the federal government, the people of the United States, still owe me my Thanksgiving dinner. I never got that because I was too far forward for them to send anything up. That was during, we were passing through in the direction of Luxembourg, in the direction of Saarbrücken and the Ruhr. Well, going back to then the 26th, on the evening of the 26th, I was ordered to report to Arlon, where the 4th Armored Division was preparing a force to go break through the Bastogne, which was surrounded by the German army. Now, there were one or two battalions of the 318th Infantry of our division, of the 300th Infantry Regiment of our division, were ordered to accompany the German, the 4th Armored Division as the infantry force to try to break through. I was to go with them with my Jeep and driver. I was to go with them to make a report direct to our own divisional headquarters as to the outcome of the attack. So we, at 4 o'clock, I hadn't been able to get to Arlon. Mm-hmm. I hadn't been able to get to Arlon yet, so the attack force had already moved out from Arlon and headed in three columns to attack Bastogne. I don't remember whether I've decided to follow the right, the left, or the center column. But I took one of those columns and with my driver, and we started to go to catch up with the attacking force. Well, we very quickly got out of our lines, and the Germans had already begun to fire on our columns. And but the distance between the Germans on either side of some of our columns was maybe 1,000 yards. Our people were passing through two lines of German soldiers on either side. They were firing at them, and tanks were being knocked out and set on fire, many people being killed and wounded, and one thing or another is just pandemonium, except we continued to press forward. I joined up about 10 o'clock that morning with the column I was following in this little place called Assinois, S-S-I-N-O-I-S, or something like that. Anyway, when I joined up, the column was halted. Now, that column, not McAuliffe, I can't remember the general command, the 4th Armored General in Command, but he was there. The column was under his command. He had given orders to attack a town to our left, that was quite some distance away and filled with German troops. And the artillery was just getting ready to fire on that town. Now, this was the first time of a clear day. This is the first clear day we had was that day, the 26th of December. And suddenly we heard a roar in the skies, and everybody looked, because you see, we thought it came from our direction, but you never know. And everybody looked, and there came squadrons of planes, hundreds and hundreds of planes, as far as the eye could see from every direction, as far back as you could see, our bombers were coming, and they flew over us. Well, the general then immediately gave the command, I wish I could remember his name, McAuliffe? I believe it was McCall. No, that was the general commander, Bastogne. Oh, heck. Anyway, when we saw that, our general in command of the column immediately said no. He says, stop the attack, and he pointed directly ahead to where another town was, this little village called Assinois. And he said, take the same plans, attack that town, will go straight into Bastogne. He says, those bombers are going to make a way. As we watched, though the bombs were beginning to fall around Bastogne on the German forces, and the whole earth just trembled from the tremendous amount of bombs falling on around Bastogne. And great columns of smoke were going up from the ammunition dumps and vehicles and tanks that were being hit by our bombers. So we immediately begin to drive directly into Assinois and take the town. Now, our infantry, that is the 318th Infantry, was the force that was helping take the town. Now, later on, we found out that this town was defended by the 5th German Parachute Division. And when I got our artillery, we had one sad part of this. Our artillery didn't judge directly quite right the timing, because as our first vehicles and tanks loaded with our men got to the edge of the village and jumped off, our artillery was still falling on the village and on the edge of the village and killing and wounding some of our own men. But when my jeep and driver got there, we jumped out of the vehicle because of the firing, and we lay down behind the first little house in the village. And as I lay there, I started to walk around and look around the corner of the house. And as I did so, a German potato masher landed right at my feet. And instinctively, I gave it a kick and knocked it out of the way and jumped behind the house. Well, that was enough for me. So I laid down there with my driver and waited till the members of the 318th and the 4th Armored Division had cleared the first houses. Then, the houses, many of them were on fire, and the German, this 5th Parachute Division of the German Army was making a very strong defense. Fact is, if I knew who the German officer was, I would certainly recommend to the German government today that he receive the Iron Cross, because when the firing in my particular area ceased, I went to the third house, and I walked into the room with my driver, and there were bodies in the place, German bodies, and we were looking on out of a window on up the road or street, sort of, and I felt a tap on my shoulder, and there was a German who spoke perfect English. He says, "We surrender to you." There were three Germans laying there pretending to be dead that surrendered, so I turned them over to a guard of the 4th Armored Division to protect, to take care of. They were having a area to collect prisoners at. And as I looked on out, I saw one of our 4th Armored Division tanks advancing down the street, and suddenly a young German officer, he had to be young because he runs so fast, took a Teller mine about this size, and he, like a disc, you know, that you throw, he swung it with his hand right under the tread of our lead tank, and the tank run over. It didn't kill anybody, I don't think, but it blew the track right there and stopped that tank. And then a little later on, towards where the German command post was, down at the other end of the village of Assomois, one of our tanks, they had several rooms, and so our tank shoved its gun right down the long hall, and the Germans were barricaded in the kitchen at the back, and they had the door shut, and I suppose they had the stuff to keep us out, but they fired their cannon right into there. And when I went later on, I walked into that room, there was one German with a German helmet blown completely into his chest, and there are chunks all over the wall of the German bodies from the explosion of the shell in that kitchen. But we took the town, and then we went on towards Bastogne, and about 8 o'clock that night, a lieutenant, who I do not know his name, of the 8th of the 4th Armored Division, made a contact with a outpost of the 101st Airborne Infantry on the outskirts of Bastogne in the perimeter of their defense. Well, I didn't get to go into Bastogne at that time because, you see, we had made the contact. So my duty was to immediately go back and report what I could, which I started back, and I got back in our own area. It's only about 20, 25 miles. But it was a little hazardous because we still didn't know whether we'd beaten. There were still German units passing back and forth across the corridor we had made. But we had no trouble getting back. And I might tell you that on one incident on the way up to join the attack and the breaking through the Bastogne, that we were fired on from a patch of timber by German machine guns, and they had every fifth shot they had was a tracer. That's a shell that leaves a light that you can judge where you're shooting. And that was tracer, the bullets. We knew the bullets were going right behind us. As we were going up this slope, while the tracers are passing right behind us, it made you feel like when you're sitting in the Jeep, you move forward, you know, just for luck, to keep them getting, be sure your fanny was out of the way of the tracers, because between every tracer is four other bullets. But as we went up the hill, it kept behind us, and we got out over the hill. Why, that stopped because we were then out of range. But that was kind of exciting. Well, anyway, I returned and reported to the division, and that in turn went to Corps. At that time, we'd been transferred to 20th Corps, and we're under Commander General Walker, I believe was his name. Yeah, General Walker. And I suppose from there, the information went on to 3rd Army and Patton. I hate to skip so much of the war, because every day was days like this, but I skip over, we broke through the Siegfried Line. My division went through it. In fact, as we went through it three times, twice on the opposition. Went in the direction of Bamberg, Nuremberg. I could tell about in Nuremberg a little incident. We got into Nuremberg, and we took cover in the house of a man that had been a major in the German army. And he had sent loot back from Poland in German ammunition boxes. And in the basement of that house, we found a solid block of silver about 2 feet by 1 foot by 1 foot that had been beaten together in a block. Now, when we looked at it closely, we saw it was silver taken from Catholic churches in Poland, friezes of saints and so on and so on. And so we wanted to make certain that he didn't have it after the war. So we took the block and went out there. He lived on a park in Nuremberg, in the center, on the side of a park. So there was a shell hole, a hole of some kind in the park. It was the night. So we went over and carried that block of silver and put it in a hole, and then kicked some dirt on it, run some of our vehicles over it. And I got an eye, I don't know where the park was, but I have an idea that that block of silver is still right there in one of those parks in Nuremberg. And then we went on, and we got into Germany, and we were advancing towards Gotha. Now, there is a town. Now, near Gotha was a concentration camp that is not like Buchenwald or Treblinka in Poland, but it was Ordruff was the name of that concentration camp. And when we went into, I was one of those to help liberate Ordruff. And when we went in, I saw some hundreds of children, boys and girls, all naked, lying in a pile waiting to be burnt. We also saw the ovens at Ordruff, and of course many, many dead, and we liberated them. And we, with all the children that we saw, quite a few of the men actually were crying. It disturbed them so. And I don't believe we took any SS men or even give them a chance to surrender for certainly a couple of days. Mm-hmm. We just shot them as fast as we saw them because the SS were, I just have no use for the SS. Well, then we ended up at Linz, Austria. And it was a little beyond Linz that one day Patton came up. And the war was still going on, but we had, I guess the high command, Schaeff, had made a decision that we were to go no further because Patton would come up with some of his staff and take his field glasses and look ahead of us. Germans would come in and say, why don't you go in and take Prague? Why don't you go on and take Prague? Or Czechoslovakians say, come and take Prague. We're the underground there is fighting, and even though we can take Prague, but we couldn't go, and we wondered why. So upon this one day, after 2-3 days gone by, Patton had come up to look down the road towards Prague. He was standing on a sort of little hill, and on a little rise of ground, and we were all around watching, and he just said, God damn it, they won't let me. Mm-hmm. So we knew right away that it was no fault of his that we weren't permitted to go ahead and take Prague advance. It was shortly about that time that he sent the 45th Division, the recon, as I recollect, of the 45th Division to rescue the Spanish horses that had been taken from Vienna in the direction of Prague. And of course they rescued the horses which I wish I could have been on that one, but I wasn't. To jump over some more time and go to the end of the war, right the last of April, we had practically conquered Germany. We were in redoubt, where the SS and the diehards were going to make their last stand, which did not materialize. But some days, Hitler had a chatelet below at Berchtesgaden, but below the Eagle's Nest. Now this chatelet had been bombed by our Air Force maybe a week or so before, I don't know which. But when we arrived there, or I arrived there, it was in ruins, but the caves that went into the hill from the chateau, on the side of the hill that the chatelet had been built, were filled with, the SS had taken the furniture and all sorts of things from the chatelet back into the caves for protection. So some members of the 2nd French Armored Division were looting the place when I got there. So I went in, and I have in the house right now a beautiful solid silver bread pan with a swastika that came right out of Hitler's hangout there, the chatelet at Berchtesgaden. Mm-hmm. Also have a flag upstairs that I took out of there, and there were some teacups, little Bavarian teacups, all hand painted and the like. I brought them home. Some of them were broken, but I have some that were when they arrived home safely. So it was from then on. Of course, we went to our division then in Bavaria. We held after the war was over. We held not Berchtesgaden. We held an area south of Munich in the Bavarian Alps, whose name was Kaufbeeren. And I might say the last thing I remember of him the importance was that two events, how we handled things. There were two swans in the little lake at Kaufbeuren, and we shot the swans in them because we were hungry.
Oh.
And we took hand grenades and threw them in some of the trout pools and stunned the fish and ate them.
Oh.
I remember that as part of the our activities right at the end of the war. Of course, we also took their beer and their Rhine wine or whatever. When I returned home in November of 1945 from Azara Lucille's Camp Lucky Strike, when I returned home, I came on a what they call a Liberty ship. It took us 10, 12 days to get back. We landed in New York and went to Camp, I don't remember the military camp. The thing I remember about it was that we had our first big steaks there and ice cream. Mm-hmm. The first ice cream I'd had in some nearly 2 years. And I ate ice cream and I ate two big steaks and I got thoroughly sick. And from then, of course, like many Decatur, Macon County boys, sent to Camp Grant and or Camp Fort Sheridan, one of the two is where most of them. I went to Camp Grant and was discharged from the Army Camp Grant. Of course, they wanted us to stay in, but with all the fighting I'd had, I decided I wasn't about to. I'd had enough of the military for a while. I wanted to come home. I might mention that a very good friend of mine who lives used to live just a few blocks from here, belonged to my boyhood gang, was killed during the Battle of the Bulge. That was Mac Henderson. Mm-hmm. Mac Henderson was killed, and I didn't find that out until, of course, I came home. But I think it's a wonderful thing to come home. It's a wonderful thing to come home. My little daughter met me at the door when I knocked at the door, and she looked pretty. I'd only seen her 2 years before. See, she's about 3 years at that time when she came to open the door for me. And I was not sure whether she was particularly anxious to see me or not, but she was suspicious. In fact, is that night, or that's Elizabeth, my daughter Elizabeth, that night when we were having our first dinner together that evening in our kitchenette, or dinette rather, with my wife and my two daughters, Mickey and Elizabeth. And at her age, I reproved her for something or other. And she looked very coldly at me and she says, "Why don't you go back into the Army? Where you belong. You can go back to the Army where you belong." After I returned home, of course, I went right back into what I had always been doing, managing our property and taking the burden off my wife of having to do all the things that had to be done. And shortly after I returned, I decided I wanted to be on the Board of Supervisors of Macon County, and I'm a Republican. So I run for the board and was elected to the board. This had to do, of course, with local affairs, county, local county taxes, and so on. I was greatly interested in that. I was 12 years on the board, and then continued to operate and take care of our business interests. But in 1966, I decided I was going to run for the state legislature, the General Assembly, and I run. Well, it was quite a fight. I had quite a fight with some of the political powers in Decatur who didn't want to see me elected. But when the final votes were counted, I had lost by 250 votes. And when I checked it out, I found that in six of the precincts, there were more votes cast than there were registered voters. Mm. And when I checked, I had asked for a discovery by law of one-fourth of them. And those one-fourth precincts discovered that actually I would have won the election, mm-hmm. but I had to have permission of the legislature to have a full recount. And when mm-hmm. I went there, they refused to do it because the gentleman I had